I'm hoping that you didn't understand much of what he said, because I'm going to say the same thing in a different way. This is, because I'm not an STI guy, I thought I'm an HIV guy, I suppose, if I'm anything. I thought I should try to learn something about STIs. And so I tried to find some data. And here's what I got from WHO, suggesting that STIs are getting worse worldwide. Of course, that's between 2005 and 2008. I thought to myself, 2008? My son just graduated from college. He was early in high school back then. This is 2012 publishing of 2008 data. It's hard to know what's going on today. Those are summarized in a map which shows total numbers per region. I guess this is useful if the WHO regional directors are sitting around saying who's better, who's worse. But I can't figure out what this has to do with performance, because that's what Pierre was talking about. It was, how do you get the system to perform better? And if most of you are in the business of trying to get better performance out of your systems, well, what are the data you are actually looking for? This, I suspect, is not very useful. These are some nice graphs. They show from region to region a few things. So if you look at this one, let's see. It suggests that in Africa, GC is about twice as bad as chlamydia. And I just stuck the HIV numbers up there. HIV, the incidence of HIV is about the same as that of syphilis in Africa. Now, mind you, I'm comparing much more current HIV numbers to 2008 STI numbers. And the prevalence of HIV is the same order of magnitude as the prevalence of TRIC. If you go on to Southeast Asia, you see, well, the male GC more than doubles, especially in comparison to women. That's a striking difference from the previous one. That's the previous one. And now HIV, the incidence of HIV is a fifth of what syphilis is. Syphilis has stayed the same across the two regions. And the prevalence of HIV is about a tenth of the prevalence of TRIC. If we switch to the Americas, boom, chlamydia just explodes. It's now four times as big as it was in the other regions, especially among women. And syphilis still the same, GC looking like it did in Africa. And HIV now, the incidence is a tenth of syphilis, and the prevalence is a 20th of TRIC. So if I think about what does this tell us about performance, well, it doesn't tell me anything, frankly. It tells me the STDs are different from region to region, and it doesn't really say anything to me about differential program performance. I can't say that, you know, African program managers are winning against chlamydia because they're doing so much better than the U.S. is, right? I mean, it would be really foolish to suggest that these data tell us that. So what did I see when I started to scour the websites for the U.S.? Well, there's a great atlas on the CDC website, and this is gonorrhea in 2012. And I'd suggest to you that looking at a map like this, you know, maybe it's good for a meeting like this when the state program directors are sitting around comparing who's better, who's worse, but it doesn't really tell us much about who's performing better. And one reason is, well, the nice thing about this map for GC is that it explodes down at the level of counties. And now this starts to become much more interesting. And it turns out, so I glance at this and I thought to myself, wow, that's a really interesting pattern for gonorrhea. In fact, it looks just like the screensaver on my desktop, which is the racial dot map. And if you look at, which I probably can't do, but the green here are dots of African Americans, blue is Caucasian, the yellowish is down here is Latino, and the brown here and here is Native American. So if you were to think about going back now to this map, you'd see that, well, we've got exactly, let's see, we've got dark here in the African American belt, and then Native American here and here is really dark, and then Latino here is dark. So it turns out that it would be, you know, I would be loath to think that we looked at this map and the state directors of GC programs felt like this was an indication of performance, because in fact, most of the variability that I can see here, just naively, is explained just by differences in racial and ethnic groups across the country. So if what I'm looking for, if I'm a state program manager and on this map here, I'm trying to think about how do I gauge county-level performance, well, I want to know how well the individuals at those counties are performing. If I'm a county manager, I want to know how I'm performing compared to others. So chlamydia, we just heard, this was 2000, nice little atlas, and this is 2012. So what it shows is that things are certainly going in the really wrong direction. And if we were comparing who was better, who was worse, well, I can tell you, everybody got worse, and New York got worse the worst. But again, is that performance? No, I don't think it is. So here's a map of Boston. And it's a map of Boston and Cambridge that is color-coded by crime statistics. Red is bad, green is good. And in my introduction, you heard I'm a graduate of MIT, and you can see MIT here is bright green. And up here, you can see Harvard, it's bright red. And the reason for that is obviously MIT performs better, right? No surprise. However, if you were a criminal and you were thinking about where am I going to go to rip off rich students, I wouldn't go to MIT. I'd go right up to Harvard. So maybe, in fact, corrected for criminals coming to rip off students, Harvard does better than MIT does because there aren't any crooks at MIT. Or it could be that, in fact, they've got the same number of crooks, but MIT, because they've had decades of MIT students trying to trick them, have to spend a lot more money on their police force, and they've gotten, and they're investing four times as much as Harvard is, and that considered on a value for money basis, Harvard actually does better. So we don't know unless we can compare these raw data, these are the equivalent of the prevalence and incidence data, with where are we investing, and what is the underlying pressure from the disease, or in this case from crime, so that I can actually know what the relative performance is. Because I want to reward people, I want to measure performance so that we can improve performance, and I want people to be able to emulate those people who are on the right hand or the best end of the performance spectrum. So since I don't know anything about STIs, as I've just proven to all of you, I'll say a few words about examples from HIV that might be illustrative. So here are countries in Africa. It doesn't really matter if you can't read which country's which, but the countries on the right over here are countries that are decreasing their number of HIV/AIDS deaths. So right-hand side is good. The ones going out to the left are bad. They're increasing deaths. And what I've done here is color code in red for you those countries that were the original PEPFAR focus countries. So where the U.S. government poured billions of dollars into HIV programs. And the good thing is that you can see that there are a lot more countries in red on the right than there are on the left, suggesting, at least, you know, the gestalt here, suggesting that PEPFAR is doing good things for reducing AIDS deaths in Africa. Now, this is the same thing, but it's incidents rather than deaths, new infections. And here you can see that almost all the countries on the continent are on the right. Almost all of them have decreasing incidence over the 10 years from 2002 to 2012, Uganda being the exception. It was the earliest improvement, and then it rebounded in the wrong direction. But what's striking here for me is that red or blue doesn't seem to make any difference. You seem to be as likely to be reducing your prevalence whether you're a PEPFAR-focused country or not. And the PEPFAR-focused countries got significantly more money than the others, and I don't have the graph here, but if I showed you the one that was all in, Global Fund, PEPFAR, et cetera, you'd see that even correcting for those that got more or less international funding, still, the amount of reduction seems to be pretty much unrelated. So we need to go to a more granular level. And the perfect example, or the best example on the African continent is probably, with all due respect to Pierre and his South African example, is probably Rwanda. Because with far fewer resources, they've done some amazing work. And this is their TrackNet system. I don't expect you to read it. It's just a screenshot. But they can look, sit there in Kigali and look clinic by clinic. The lower right-hand graph is a measure of what the drug supply looks like in that area of the country or that clinic. They can look at CD4 initiation rates. They can look at continuation rates at the level of individual clinics with a national monitoring system and compare performance. This is an example of some costing work that was done in Rwanda by the Clinton Health Access Initiative in collaboration with the ministry. And you can see here the sample of clinics. Each bar there is a clinic with the cost of providing a year's worth of ART in the clinic. And you can see there are big differences, relatively big differences anyway. I mean, the least expensive clinic over here is almost a third of what the most expensive clinic is. And yet, up at the top, what you see, that blue line there, is retention rates. So there seems to be no correlation between a clinic's ability to keep somebody healthy and enrolled in care and how much it costs to treat that patient in a small, relatively homogeneous country, right? So this variability in cost, we can't explain it on the basis of results. It's a really important thing. So maybe the most expensive clinics who are not performing any better than the least expensive clinics have some learning to do. And in fact, when PEPFAR did a similar analysis in Mozambique in 2009, they showed on the left here this variability, which goes from about $170 to almost $900 per patient per year. But by revealing that variability and the causes of that variability to the clinics without any draconian program, just sunlight on the variability and the causes of the variability, you see on the right what happened 2 years later in terms of a reduction of that variability. Now, these are some data that I worked on. There were five countries. I worked on them in Mexico back in 2004. And these are looking at the cost of HIV testing and counseling, about the most standard intervention across five countries. It was India, Uganda, South Africa, Mexico, and Zambia. And what you see here is remarkable because these are log graphs. So when Ford created Model Ts, if you produce a lot of something, you tend to be able to do it cheaper per unit. So the big clinics, that's the horizontal axis, that's number of patients per year in the clinic or clients per year, the bigger clinics have a tendency of being lower cost than the smaller clinics or the clinics that serve fewer patients, not necessarily smaller clinics. In fact, about a 97% reduction, if you look at that curve, across the clinics that go from, 10 to 10,000 per year. But that's not the surprising part. That's the expected part. The surprising part is that at the same scale, you can have, at 50 clients, a 99% reduction from the most expensive clinic to the least expensive clinic. Now, when we first, the very first costing studies in Uganda of the cost of VCT, way back when, we were fighting about, was it $17 or $24? Because we had two different studies, and one said 17, one said 24. In fact, here we're seeing two orders of magnitude difference, oftentimes in a single country, between a clinic providing a service and another clinic providing the same service. And it's not like, one is up in the mountains of Bhutan and the other one is in New York City. These are pretty standard services. And most of this difference is explained away just by utilization. When you set up a clinic and you fully staff it and you pay the rent and nobody comes, it's really expensive per person. Right? That's what explains most of this difference. Even at larger scale, now you'll notice that the variability reduces. You don't have clinics at 10,000 that have that two orders of magnitude difference. But even at 5,000, or no, this is a 2,400 VCT visits per year, there's a 90% decrease from the top to the bottom of that. So this suggests that at least in 2004, there are huge issues of inefficiency in the system. And that inefficiency could be used to serve a whole lot more people. So, more recent results. This is now 2011-2012 from Zambia. And unfortunately, unlike the example I showed you from Mozambique, the same is true. Because we're not in the prevention sphere in HIV. We're not holding people accountable the way they've been held accountable in treatment. And remember, they've been largely held accountable by patients in treatment, because there are people waiting for treatment. So we have to apply the pressures that PEPFAR felt and applied itself to itself in some of its treatment programs to our prevention world, because there's no evidence of improvement in that prevention space. And then if you looked at those same voluntary counseling and testing, well, it turns out that, of course, we'd like people to know their status. That's a good thing, right? But the really important reason why we test people is to identify people who are positive, because people who are positive can get into treatment, and we know that that is good for them and it's good for reduction of transmission. So we get very, very little of the potential benefit when we just test somebody. If we test somebody and identify somebody who's positive, that's better. If we identify somebody and test them and find that they're positive and get them started on treatment, that's when we actually realize the benefit. So here you can see from Zambia, about $25 per person tested. Those are not the most efficient ones, that's just the average, right? But on average, almost $200 per person who's positive. Now, just that alone, if you're managing the program, if you're rewarding people for how many people they test, the easy thing to do is to keep testing the people who are easy to test. But if what we care about is finding people who are positive, then we shouldn't be measuring how many people we test. We should be measuring how many positive people we identify, newly identify. And if we do that, we would structure the program very differently, and we would reward the managers very differently. And instead of testing as many people, as you can see from the difference in the height of these graphs, who are negative, we would focus on identifying people who haven't been tested for a long time and are more likely to be positive. And then we don't even know what the cost would be per person identified and started on treatment. But I know I was sitting with some managers of a program in the Congo not too long ago, and they've done a very good job testing 450,000 people. But unfortunately, the people who were supposed to be offering the clinical services weren't really doing that, and so people were learning that they were positive but not starting therapy. So if we are spending $200 per person just on the testing scheme to identify a positive person, and we're only getting, let's say, a fifth of those started on therapy, then we're spending $1,000 just on testing per person started on therapy. And my point here is that if we're not looking at the relationship between the dollars and the performance of the program, we don't really understand what the performance of the program is. So here's a thought for you. Change back now to just sort of generic prevention. In this case, HIV, could be STIs, doesn't matter. I'm an economist, I just make up the numbers anyway. And I say, I just drew a graph here, and this is a graph of, on the horizontal axis, resources dedicated to HIV prevention, and on the vertical axis, HIV infections prevented. And like most things, I drew a graph that looks like this, because most things, as you spend more and more and more, whether it's on cars or computers or anything else, you start getting less and less and less. You know, the difference between a Mercedes and a Maserati may be something, but it's not that much compared to what it is between a bicycle and a Volkswagen, right? So if this is the way the curve looks, we might spend our resources to make sure that we're in that vertical part of the curve, so we're trying to spread out our HIV prevention resources or our STI prevention resources to as many places as possible because those early dollars are worth more than the late dollars. But what if, in fact, that's not true? What if, in fact, in HIV prevention, it's more like tobacco, where you invest and you invest and you invest, and suddenly you get to a tipping point, social norms change, and all of a sudden a community-level behavior switches radically, right? We went from smoking in every bar in New York to not smoking in every bar in New York rather precipitously. And then the amazing thing was, then Paris did that, and then Mexico City did that, right? These rather tipping point shifts, they may be much more common in sexual behavior than it is compared to, you know, quality of transport as you go from bicycle to Volkswagen to Maserati. So if in fact the graph looks like this, we could invest this one amount of money at the bottom of the curve where it says FD here at the bottom. Oops, if I pointed at my screen, you won't see anything. If we invest down here, we get that much vertical benefit. If we invest here, we get that much vertical benefit. So obviously, just like the other one, it's very different, but we're not up there yet. We haven't invested that much yet. So if we're starting off, what can we do? Well, we can decide to invest in three different communities down here, and we'll get that much benefit. Those are three versions of, or we can say, well, hang on a second, I'm going to invest that much money all in one community, and then how much benefit am I going to get? Well, then I'm going to drive that community over the tipping point, and I'm going to get a whole lot more benefit. And if I do that, well, that might be like the New York to Paris to Mexico City example. Maybe the next places nearby are going to tip faster and easier because I tipped the first ones. So just something to think about. I'm out of time, so I'm not going to give you the last example, but I will leave you with my last message. And that is, we're going to do the kind of stuff that Pierre said only if we're managing performance. Most of us in this room here are managers. We've got to manage performance, and we can't manage at the level of a country or a state. We have to have the data on the disease and on the effectiveness of the program and on the cost, the value for money of the program at the level of the units that deliver services. Starbucks would never tell you how well Atlanta is performing, right? Starbucks will tell you how many coffees they're producing at a Starbucks shop and what it costs them to do that, because they measure their performance shop by shop by shop. They don't measure Atlanta performance, and they certainly don't measure Georgia performance. We've got to start doing the same thing in public health. Thank you very much.
So we can take a few questions. Do we have mics? I cannot see. Are there any questions?
We can hear you. Okay. Yeah. So thank you for both of those very refreshing presentations. As managers, I think one of the problems is modeling what to do for each of those. And HIV and syphilis have advantages in that they are narrower, at least in some jurisdictions, narrow in focus. Once you treat an HIV person, you take them out of the mix. So they no longer enter into the susceptible people. And if it takes a week to treat chlamydia, but you don't get the partners for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, then they enter the susceptible population again. So one of the problems that I find is that we don't have the information to make those models work and to measure performance in a meaningful way. We tripled the amount of money we spent on testing in the last 5 years, and we found a lot more cases. Our prevalence, so our percent positives are going down. Our number of cases, of course, which is what is measured, and measured by a denominator that is the county rather than the number of tests, is going up. So getting the correct performance measures, I think, is critical, but also calculating, really, can we afford to control chlamydia? You know, the amount of money that we spend on tests varies from $12.50 to $26 per test, let alone per site. So we don't really have the information to design performance measures. And so how would you sort of, from your perspectives, suggest that we go about doing that and getting the numbers that we need to do that?
Well, I love the idea that we should take a broader view and be measuring the number of positive infections. In South Africa, we did a calculation which was based on the population that was served by any one clinic, and the known prevalence in that general area. What was the actual number of people that we predict that we should find in that area every year, and then design a system to go find them, test them, and put them on treatment? And that approach was very helpful for the managers. So the managers actually now had a number. And then they could devise the strategies, and the strategies were amazing because they were all local strategies. Those local ideas then were collected into that compendium that I showed you that were then applicable more widely. But I think starting off with a number, with a single, and it's a number, it's not a ratio, it's not a proportion, it is the actual number for your catchment area, and then designing back a system to support that number is the way I would suggest.
And I just add to that I'm a modeler, so I'm the last person to argue against modeling. But I actually think that we have a huge amount of information that we're not taking advantage of, which is the result of just the empirical random walk that happens out there. So if we look at that map of chlamydia by county across the country, there's a huge amount of variability there. And understanding which colleagues, first of all, the question for me is not what the prevalence is or even what the incidence is, it's what the change is in that. In other words, the performance is really the direction in which it's going is a much better proxy for performance. And that related to how much they're spending per person. So if you did that and you had a different heat map where you were looking at what at least that was suggesting were the best practice examples, and what could we learn from the best practice examples, and doing what I suggested with the PEPFAR is that by revealing that difference in performance for money invested, we might learn from our colleagues who, for even if it's just randomly, they got to a place that works better than some other places. So revealing that heterogeneity and linking it to the money, I think, is incredibly important. And I think that you do have the data to be able to look at that comparatively across places. Shout.
Don?
Sorry.
Sorry about that. Tom Peterman, Division of STD Prevention at CDC. And I hear a lot about treatment as prevention for HIV. And if I was at Starbucks, I would want to know how much I'm preventing for each case that I treat. And so I'm wondering, does anyone target treatment according to how much they're going to prevent, and do they measure that?
Well, there are a series of studies, one of them supported by the CDC, in Africa looking exactly at this. So what people are doing is trying to measure the differential benefit of different approaches to treatment as prevention on prevention. And the question is, are you going to focus your treatment as prevention efforts on populations most likely to benefit from that? That requires targeting people most likely to transmit. And there's been lots of discussion about what that would mean. So I've been engaged in a number of those discussions because, for example, when WHO put out their initial guidelines suggesting that we should target treatment as prevention on people who were in discordant relationships. Because if you were in a discordant relationship, you were self-evidently most likely to transmit. And my response was, well, no, not necessarily. Because people who are in discordant relationships mean that, by definition, they know that they're in a discordant relationship. And in fact, the evidence suggests that when people know that they're in a discordant relationship, transmission is substantially reduced. The people we're most concerned about are the people who are HIV positive, who are having sex with lots of people, in relationships in which both parties don't know that they're discordant. So this question of to whom should you target treatment as prevention is, I think, a very hot one. Practically speaking, though, the programs are scaling it up relatively uniformly. And then what happened with that was, are you going to do it by treating whoever comes to the clinic, or are you going to try to find people who, at least because of viral load, are most likely to transmit? And that has to do with the relative cost of doing both. It turns out that the cost of having somebody in your clinic and maintaining them not on antiretroviral treatment until you think that they're get to the point where they're most in need of treatment, that's so expensive that you might as well treat them. So my views on it have actually shifted. I initially thought that we were most interested in going out and finding the people most likely to need treatment as prevention, but I've come to think that probably we should be treating all those we can and expanding that circle. But that's where some modeling actually can be very helpful, combined with the empirical results from the studies that are ongoing.
Thank you to Dr. Bertozzi and Dr. Barker.